This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today we're taking you to a vigil, one of many, for the victims of the shooting in El Paso last weekend. There have been commemorations all over the country this week.
Under this administration, in visceral and vicious ways, overt attacks on immigrants and people of color have been verbalized and concretized in ways that we have not seen since Operation Wetback in 1954, when another president did the same thing.
These elected officials are coming out because they need that vote. If you want change, or organize, mobilize, do not stop.
In 1992, I lived here on Garfield, and I have seen throughout these years in my activism how we've gone from being scapegoats to being targets. That's the reality that we have right now.
Oh, somebody's hurting our neighbors, and it's gone on far. You know that it's gone on far too long.
Just a few of the sounds from vigils all around the nation. Now, there were commemorations in Pasadena and Pomona as well. And the reason this is so emotional for so many people in Greater LA is because of the large Latino population, obviously, but also because for years, El Paso was a funnel from Mexico to Los Angeles. There are a lot of people here with a lot of ties to El Paso. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times. He's been writing about this connection. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
And we're also joined by Gabriel Tenorio, who lives in Boyle Heights. He was born in El Paso. Hi, Gabriel.
Buenos dias.
I'm going to start with you, Gabriel, because I want to know your story, your connection. You were born in El Paso, but I speak, and Gustavo will speak about this connection between El Paso and Los Angeles. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I was born, you know, in the 70s. So I was a part of, I think, like kind of this weird migratory pattern that was happening. I lived there till about I was 4 years old, but, you know, a lot of us in El Paso ended up in Los Angeles. For us, it was, you know, an opportunity for a better life. My mom was undocumented. So, you know, the prospects for an undocumented single mother in El Paso at the time weren't very good. So we moved to Los Angeles following a lot of family members. And we found ourselves, you know, here in Boyle Heights in East LA, among a lot of transplants from Juarez and El Paso. It was a yearly tradition to go for the holidays, to go for all summer long in El Paso, where it was much safer than, you know, to be alone in Boyle Heights at the time. So, you know, I spent a lot of my childhood having the best days of my childhood in El Paso. It was the kind of thing that you could let your kids kind of just play outside all day long, and you get home and, you know, everything's cool. So when I heard of what had happened and I heard the location, it just kind of really hit me hard, because that's where we spent our time as kids skateboarding. You know, I guess I'm part of that same generation as Beto O'Rourke, the El Paso skateboarders, you know, that we were getting kicked out of parking lots left and right, Cielo Vista Mall and that Walmart, you know, that area is one of them. I mean, we were there daily in the summertime. And then to have that weekend, have it be like back to school weekend, which if anyone in El Paso knows, it's a big deal. Kids get really amped up. Families get really excited about, you know, picking out their outfits and getting their school supplies. And, you know, folks from both sides of the border are in El Paso shopping on that weekend. So to have that, I think it was just really, it was shocking. I think we're still all processing it here.
You still have family in El Paso, right? Did you check on them?
Yes, and through the networks, social networks, and through just, you know, phone trees, everybody's just making sure everyone is safe. Both my wife and I have family there. Her parents are there, my grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nieces and their family. So luckily, you know, that is our area. Like, you know, my aunt has two houses, you know, one for her and one for her niece, right up the street on Hawkins, off of Hawkins. So, you know, the possibility that someone that we know might be there was high. I mean, El Paso, albeit growing, and it's a city, it's a bigger city now, but it always feels small, especially if you're from there. I mean, chances of seeing someone you know are always high.
Gustavo, Gabriel's not alone. There are a whole lot of folks from El Paso, right here in Greater LA. Tell us a bit about that story. Why is there such a connection between the two cities?
It's a connection that goes back for over a century, basically ever since the Mexican Revolution. In my story, I noted that naturalization records by the federal government show that 60% of the people who came to Mexicans who came to Southern California from 1900 to 1945 went through El Paso, because for decades that was the only place that you could get into the United States. Like my own grandpa, who ended up in Anaheim in 1918, he crossed the border. He paid a penny for his, not even a passport, it was for his green card to come in. And so in those days, you know, LA was growing. LA had a lot of work. So people would just get on the Southern Pacific Railroad and go all the way to Los Angeles. Once Interstate 10 got built in the 1950s, you just get on that highway and then move. And so a lot of people started, like, even if you only crossed El Paso, that still resonated with you. But you also had, you know, El Paso. People forget how relatively isolated El Paso is from the rest of Texas or New Mexico. That's why it was always closer in culture, instead of to Texas, to Juarez. You got Juarez right across the border. So there's not much opportunity. So you had generations of people like Gabriel's family, a lot of my friends. And then more importantly for me, or, you know, for Southern California, basically what we know as Southern California Mexican-American culture was in large parts formed by people from El Paso.
Let's talk about that culture, because I wonder if you notice much of that impact. Like, what do you see that is El Paso here in L.A. culturally?
Back in the day, of course, you had the pachucos, the zoot suiters. Those came from El Paso. In fact, the word pachuco, people say, comes from the idea of people going para el chuco, chuco being the nickname for El Paso. The whole East LA accent, the whole you know and East Los, that's all El Pasoisms that went to Los Angeles. You had Ruben Salazar, the legendary martyred columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He was born in El Paso. You had Lupe Ontiveros, actress who played hundreds of roles, almost always maids, from El Paso. The pioneer LGBT author John Recchi, he's also from El Paso, but lived most of his life in California. And more importantly, on the political front, I talked to Mario T. Garcia from UC Santa Barbara, this very famous Chicano studies from there, but also from El Paso. He said that the long activism in El Paso, both from the immigrant and labor fronts, those carried over directly to Los Angeles during the 1950s and 1960s. So in some ways, this whole Latino takeover of Sacramento in recent years, with the Latino Legislative Caucus being as confrontational and really being as progressive as it is, you could trace that all the way back to people from El Paso.
Can I actually, I want to add one thing.
Go ahead.
Just so we know about the impact of El Paso on Los Angeles. You know, the family that brought us Cedos, this very famous, you know, Boyle Heights institution for about 45 years. You know, that recipe for that salsa that was on the first page of Jonathan Gold's book on LA food, on Mexican food in LA, was about that salsa at Cedos. I mean, that's how impactful that the things that we consider very Mexican have a huge part to do with El Paso. El Paso is at the root of a lot of us. Remember, El Paso is where all of Mexican culture passed through. All of the Mexicanness that we know passed through El Paso. It's called the pass for a reason. And we're a part of that. And, you know, LA is still a part of that too. It's a part of a long thread. That's how I always keep perspective on things. It's like, this is part of a longer story, you know?
Gabriel, we've been talking about this fear within the immigrant community for a long time, and it didn't start certainly with the Trump administration, but it certainly has been ramped up over the past 2 to 3 years. Just yesterday, hundreds of people were arrested at a food processing plant in Mississippi. They were taken into custody by ICE. What is it about those kinds of fear? Like, those are very specific and very different kinds of fear. How would you differentiate them? I mean, in the community, feeling like, you know, at any time you could be targeted by ICE or by a shooter.
You know, if you spent enough time with an older Chicano or older Mexican American person, they would tell you the history. So that lives on, that awareness, that hyper awareness lives on. And, you know, a lot of us were kind of like, I think, ringing that bell, you know, making that shout out saying, hey, this is coming. This is what we see. These are patterns, you know, and to see it flesh out incrementally, but, you know, kind of ramping up in speed is really, really scary. Like, personally, my wife is actually very much reticent to take our son across the border. He's 3 years old. You know, she's dark-skinned, we're all brown-skinned folk, and the idea that something could happen and that we might be detained for whatever reason, and it has happened. Those things have happened. We don't take those chances. I still am spoken to in Spanish. People think I'm, you know, I only speak Spanish. The look on my face is not of an American citizen, apparently. And I'm reminded of that daily, whether, you know, Trump was in office or not.
You're an American citizen, Gabriel, and your wife and your son. You're all American citizens.
Yes.
Born in this country, right?
Yes, sir.
And you're afraid to cross over the border.
I'm okay with it, but I have to respect my wife's, you know, intuition and her feeling. You know, my mom's not a citizen. She has her residency. And as soon as things started to kind of get on the legalistic side where people were saying that maybe, you know, folks could have their residencies, you know, taken away, or even people like me who were born in birthing clinics on the American side of the border, that's what Texas healthcare was like back then, especially for immigrant families. So to think that, you know, that might be in question, you know, what could happen? And, you know, when you hear stories about kids losing their parents on the way to school, or they're coming home from school and their parents are gone, you know, this is our only son. We're, you know, my wife and they, and it's like, we don't want to take chances. You know, I have to think about that.
Gustavo, we were speaking with a coworker here at KCRW. It was yesterday. We were just standing around in the newsroom, and she's of Mexican descent. Born here in this country, though. And she said, even though she's a U.S. citizen, born in this country for the first time ever, she started to carry a photocopy of her passport.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles, California. Is that the type of fear and precaution that you're hearing about in the Latino community?
Oh, I was born and raised in Orange County, so we've been ahead of this fear game for a long, long time. I walk around everywhere with my passport, and I know that even if I have a passport, that's not going to help me much if there's certain elements of something that does not want me here in this country. And you know what Gabriel said earlier, like, you know, if you know your Mexican-American history, you know that the Mexican, the quote-unquote Mexican, I put him in quotes, it remains one of the most despised characters in the annals of American history. I mean, really, you have the three groups that the United States has historically maligned and killed and just hated more than any are the Native Americans, African Americans, and then Mexicans. Like, the history's all there. Lynchings, resolutions, all of that. And I try to never, I always try to keep that in mind so I don't try to sound too alarmist. But the truth is it. I mean, the truth is there. And now you have a madman in El Paso telling to the police officers he wanted to kill as many Mexicans as possible because he felt a Hispanic invasion of Texas. This in El Paso, one of the most Mexican big cities in the United States, he's saying that there's an invasion of Hispanics. It's terrible. It's terrible, but I hate to say it, it's nothing new.
Gabriel, you have fond memories of El Paso in the aftermath of what happened at that Walmart, at that shopping center. Has the perspective changed, do you think? Are you more fearful of going there? Are you more fearful of going into public?
I'm not, but I think when I think about, you know, the feelings my family has, I have to take that into consideration. I will go back to El Paso, of course. I mean, we have to go for family reasons. And the thing that just kind of struck me was that one peaceful place where you can go back to, that place of returning to somewhere idyllic and bucolic, is gone. You know, not that El Paso or Juarez were ever these, you know, oases of peace and kindness and everything, but, you know, it was our home and it was where we grew up, where we felt it was ours. We felt comfortable there. We felt like, hey, the kids can be outside playing. The kids will be fine. That kind of thing. That's gone. You know, like, I know I can't keep that. Maybe it was a fallacy to begin with. I can't keep that in my head now. You know, we have to kind of really understand what's happening politically. And so I think that's what's changed the most. It's just that, you know, every single veil has been lifted.
I want to thank you, Gabriel Tenorio, resident of Boyle Heights, native to El Paso. used to go skateboarding in that Walmart parking lot. And here we are today talking about that Walmart. Gabriel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gustavo Arellano, of course, our regular here on Greater LA with our Orange County line today, talking about our El Paso connection as well. Gustavo, thank you.
Gracias.
Well, we want to hear from you now. How are you feeling these days? Do you feel safe? Is there any hope to get a handle on gun violence and mass shootings in our nation? Hit us up at our KCRW Facebook and Twitter pages, hashtag it Greater LA. You can also reach out to me personally at Radio Chio on Twitter. Coming up, voters in Guatemala are going to the polls this weekend. So are Guatemalans right here in Los Angeles. What are their concerns? That's next on KCRW's Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Now to another immigrant population in Los Angeles. Pretty much any day of the week, if you ever want to meet some Guatemalans, there's one corner in Echo Park that is a good place to go. There's a family here selling agua fresca, another selling tamales, Guatemalan style. Instead of being wrapped in corn husks, the package of masa and meat sits inside banana leaves. They hang out here at the corner of Riverside and Newell Street near the 5 Freeway because this is where the Guatemalan consulate sits, behind an iron fence with guards.
Okay, okay. Gracias.
If you need to get a new passport or solve any issues with a visa or legal problems, there's really only one place for Guatemalans living in LA to go. This weekend, you can do something else there, too. Vote.
This is going to be the first time that Guatemalan nationals are going to be able to vote outside of Guatemala.
Jose Barrios is the Guatemalan Consul General in L.A., and he's talking about Guatemala's runoff election for president this weekend on Sunday. Now, that nation of roughly 17 million has 800,000 of its people living right here in Southern California, and their vote theoretically could affect the future of their homeland. The presidential candidates have even come here to Los Angeles to campaign to those expat voters. But will those voters actually go to the consulate and cast a ballot? More on that story now in KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb.
If you ask Jose Barrios about the biggest problem facing Guatemala ahead of this week's elections, he will tell you.
Mainly poverty, and of course all the consequences of poverty, lack of employment.
State figures say nearly 60% of the country lives in poverty. And Guatemala has a long history of government corruption. The question is, will either candidate change that?
No. I think at this point, it's beyond even us trying to prove that they're part of a corrupt system. I think at this point, these institutions have to prove to us that they're not.
Floridama Bo Lopez is a Guatemalan scholar and a professor at Cal State University, LA.
As much as we want to use this opportunity to pressure whoever the new president is going to be, and we see this as like, okay, this is the moment where they're making promises, promises that we can hold them accountable to in the future. What we've seen time and again is that they have no shame in breaking those promises.
That may be why so few Guatemalans in Southern California have actually registered to vote, roughly 2%. Even so, a big part of the country's economy is still built right here on the streets of L.A. by vendors like the ones outside the consulate. Here's Barrios explaining just how much we're talking about.
Guatemala receives over $9 billion a year from remittances, from the money they send from here.
That transfer of money has been a big topic for the candidates running for president. There are two to choose from, a former first lady and left-wing populist named Sandra Torres, and a right-wing politico, Alejandro Iamatetti. It's also been weaponized by President Donald Trump. Last month, he threatened to tax all the money that Guatemalans in the U.S. send back home unless the current president agreed to an immigration deal.
And they're doing what we've asked them to do, and I think it's going to be a great thing for Guatemala. They don't want these problems either.
This so-called safe third country agreement requires Guatemala to take in potentially thousands of migrants from neighboring Honduras and El Salvador. It's all part of the Trump administration's attempt to restrict asylum to the U.S. Torres, the leftist candidate, recently spoke out against Trump's power play. Presidente, pare las torpezas, she wrote on Twitter, meaning stop with the stupidity. Ian Matetti has criticized Torres for her lack of understanding about the deal and has pledged to examine it when he's elected president. For many people here in the Guatemalan diaspora, political questions like these are less important than simply surviving. It was tough at home, and it's tough here too. Are there issues that are unique to the diaspora? I mean, compared to what's happening back home?
I think it depends on scale that we're thinking about. I think the policies and the laws that marginalize us may be a little bit distinct, right? We're thinking about citizenship. That's not necessarily legal citizenship. It's not necessarily something we have to worry about in Guatemala. But citizenship defined by any other metric, we do, right? And so I think the differences are actually quite minimal. I think a lot of the systems that are pushing us into the margins are really similar, right? It's state violence, it's police brutality, it's exploitation of our labor, it's the theft of our territories in Guatemala. I also want to acknowledge that for a lot of our families and communities living in Guatemala, they do feel like we are more fortunate because we are here. And I think that is partially because when you haven't migrated, you don't understand what migration requires. You don't understand the sacrifice and the hate that you literally feel in this country. And so I think there is a sense of fear, but there is also a sense of outrage. We know that this is not right. We know that we don't deserve this. We know that we shouldn't be treated this way. And we know that if we leave, it's not because we're abandoning Guatemala, it's because Guatemala abandoned us a long time ago.
Bo Lopez says she came to the U.S. when she was just 2 years old. And her story is similar to those of other Central American immigrants.
I was completely undocumented, literally crossed on the shoulders of a coyote. There's such a strong legacy of fear when it comes to migration, especially undocumented migration, that I know that there are members in my family that are always like careful about what you say publicly.
Bo Lopez eventually became a U.S. citizen right before she graduated high school. But her experience being undocumented and the racism she felt growing up in the U.S. mirrors what many Guatemalans are going through today. Guatemalans like Moises Monteroso. He sells handicrafts from his home country right outside of the consulates. Multicolored bags, clothes, toys, you name it. He says he posts up here because a lot of Guatemalans come to the consulate and when they leave, they like seeing things from back home. But Monteroso admits this is a tough way to make a living, especially when you're undocumented and you have two kids back at home. It's the treatment of the undocumented that has become the most important issue for many voters, including Erlinda Ordóñez. He labors over a hot grill affixed to a trailer every day outside of the consulate, tosses on plastic goggles after slathering slabs of thin beef with oil. His food truck serves Guatemalan street food favorites, chucos, or Guatemalan hot dogs, and steak tortas.
Bueno, en realidad sí es una, aunque no se ve claro, es una cierta persecución. A los indocumentados y pues en realidad es quisiéramos en algún futuro cercano que hubiera una oportunidad principal.
We would like, he says, in the near future for more opportunity for people, especially those who have been here contributing for years.
Me gustaría una ventana de una oportunidad.
Ordóñez is registered to vote and he says he plans to do so.
No podría yo votar por ella porque en realidad ya.
Ordóñez says he's not going to vote for Torres because she's already shown what she's capable of, and it doesn't work. He says it's time for a change. For KCRW, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb.
Well, we certainly have a lot to talk about these days. We'd love to hear from you. Online, of course, hit us up at our KCRW Twitter or Facebook pages, hashtag it Greater LA. I'm at Radio Chio on Twitter. And that's it for today. Next week, a bill to extend closing times at bars all over Greater LA. Will the governor sign it? The last one didn't. And combating loneliness for seniors from a call center in Manila. You can hear us anytime at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Grab the podcast anytime, wherever you get them. I'd like to thank Catherine Barnes and Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, and Christian Bordahl for making this show happen each and every day. I'm Steve Chiotakis, honored by your presence. Thanks for your time and for your ear. Have a great day. Coming up next on KCRW, it's a special edition of Bookworm with Michael Silverblatt and in honor of the late, great Toni Morrison, an interview with her from 2009.